Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Game of Thrones, an unofficial Game of Thrones podcast from Vanity Fair. I am senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Every week we break down the latest episode of Game of Thrones as well as talk to some people who were involved in said episode. This week we will be talking to some of the VFX people, the clever VFX people who put together this whole big battle episode that involved dragons and giants and little girls. Oh my. But yeah, before we get into that, we will be breaking down season 8, episode 3, The Long Night, which is written by Weiss and Benioff and directed by Miguel Sapochnik. This is the battle episode that they spent over 50 nights shooting. And it's sort of all there on the screen. There it is. Everyone looks really tired and weary and battle worn from having done this. What we like to do here on Still Watching is sort of hand out a few little awards before we talk generally about the episode. First, I do a quick little recap of the episode. I think this one's like a really quick one. It's just a 2-word recap, which is Winterfell, right? Winterfell at Winterfell.
Yeah. At long last.
Yeah. R.I.P. the Night King. All right. And then we want to hand out our obvious MVP awards. This is sort of a 1-2 punch. My obvious MVP is Melisandre, who like shows up like the like glamorous messy bitch she is, loves an entrance, lights up the whole episode, like literally lights up the episode. Like this episode is very dark and hard to see except for the times when Melisandre decides to light it all up for us. So Melisandre, and then speaking some words of encouragement for people. So Richard, who is your obvious MVP of the episode?
Well, the person she spoke the most words of encouragement to, Arya.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Arya gets our big surprise move at the end of the episode. Then we're going to do the sneaky MVP, and this is also related to Melisandre. I'm going to give it out to the people who deal with the pyrotechnics. I know that at least one of those people is Sam Conway, who we talked for on a previous episode of Still Watching. We talked to him about all the people he lit on fire for the episode Spoils of War that was in season 7. And so not as many people on fire, but a lot more stuff on fire in this episode. And like the shot of the charging Dothraki with their Arryx on fire, like there were definitely just like a bunch of people on horses with things on fire. Like that wasn't CG. That was definitely real fire. And I was deeply impressed by that. So, hats off to the pyrotechnics. Who is your sneaky MVP, Richard?
Well, it's hard to argue with that, but I guess, you know, as a sort of like rest in power, I'll go with, the little lady who took down a big giant Lyanna Mormont. Poor thing.
The tiny bear cub, with the deadly aim. It's true. All right. And then we want to pick out our favorite quote. I think we're both going to be quoting the only person who said anything interesting this episode that wasn't like, run, open the door, shut the door, whatever. And yeah, so this one goes out to you, Melisandre. It goes like this. I'll be dead before the dawn. Which is sort of how I was feeling last night as I was writing all through the night about Game of Thrones. Richard, what is your quote?
Well, I'm going to give it to my MVP, Arya, and just say, not today.
Nice, nice, very nice. All right. And then we want to talk about our best dressed. This is a tough episode to pick because everyone is like dressed for battle. Jon, for some reason, not wearing any armor, in the biggest fight of his life, I would say. He's just wearing some nice leathers. So that's an interesting choice. Daenerys also chose to stick with her like usual winter wear. No armor for our lady, our mother of dragons. But I think the best dressed in terms of like coordinated look has to be, the White Walker bros, especially that shot where they're like walking out of the firelit fog in like full boy band formation, mm-hmm. With their like dramatic shoulder pads and everything sort of looking just clean and put together. So it's functional, but it's fashion. Who is your best dressed, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, that was very Billboard Music Awards, like 1999, maybe.
Yeah.
I appreciated it. I was going to say that the zombie lady that Arya stabs in the neck was looking pretty good in her tatters, but it just popped in my head. I'm giving best dress to whatever loungewear Cersei was wearing for this whole episode.
I'm sure it was silky and like maybe kind of embroidered. And yeah, I'm sure it was lovely.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right. And then finally, we want to shout out our favorite like ship of the episode, two characters or a character and an inanimate object that we are like rooting for to be together. My ship is actually the same this week as it was last week, which it goes to Bran and Jaime, who fought side by side. They are among a few characters who like reasonably should not have survived this episode, somehow did. But there was at least one shot of them fighting back to back, which gave me like Kylo Ren Rey from Star Wars feelings. And, I thought it looked great. So I appreciated all the times that they killed zombies for each other. Is what I will say. Richard, who are you shipping this week?
Well, we didn't really see them kill anyone together, but I did feel a similar stirring, I have to say, with Tyrion and Sansa, because they had that great moment where they pulled out their knives and it was like, are they going to kill themselves? Like, it was like, well, here we are. We've been through a lot together. Let's, you know, make one last stand, or so they thought. I don't know. It was a nice moment. And the music, as ever, was beautiful in that part.
Yeah, Ramin Djawadi really did it. In a previous episode of the podcast, he was talking about how my favorite piece of his music before this is called The Light of the Seven, which is from the episode The Winds of Winter, and that is the first time he had ever used piano on Game of Thrones, and I don't think he'd used it since until this episode. So it really stands out because you're not used to hearing piano on the soundtrack for Game of Thrones, and since he's only used it twice. And so yeah, and I believe this track is called the main track that plays this episode is called I believe it's called The Night King, and it is on Spotify. So you can listen to that right now. Well, not right now. You're going to listen to us and then you can listen to it. all right. So let's talk about this episode, and I will just give you my sort of brief thoughts about it before I hear yours, which is that it works well in sections. But sort of like the Beyond the Wall episode, last season where they all went like, you know, hunting for zombies in the north, it doesn't really hang together logically. If you sort of try to scrutinize it, and maybe I shouldn't try to scrutinize it, but that's literally my job. And so like when rewatching the episode, I was like, wait, why did he and what and where did she and why did that happen? And it doesn't, there's a part where, and this is the part that sticks with me most, and I don't know why. There's a part where Jon Snow just like parks his dragon on a rampart of Winterfell and just like sits there for like 20 minutes of the battle. And I don't understand why. And so like it's stuff like that where like I understand they were juggling a lot of elements. But maybe that means they bit off like a little more than they could chew, because it just, it felt, yeah, like it doesn't hang together logically. And then also, just as many people pointed out, it was hard to see what was going on a lot of the times. And so you're just like, you're like, did a favorite character die? I honestly don't know. So, Richard, but I did love like the big moment at the end. I did really like that. So Richard, what did you think of this episode?
Yeah, it was something where I was watching with friends and we were like dead silent the whole time, like totally sitting on the edge of our seats. I thought there were moments that were beautifully directed. And you know, just kind of stunning to be watching that and be like, well, this is television. I mean, you know, look at what television looks like now. So yeah, that'll, but like the more I thought about it after my friends left and I thought about recording this episode with you this morning, like I was like, well, that didn't quite work and that doesn't make any sense. And actually, the more I think about it, I really don't like the ending.
Okay. Talk to me about why you don't like the ending.
Well, I think, you know, this is a sentiment that was expressed on Twitter a lot. And I know that Martin has always said that he's more interested in the kind of dynastic power struggles than he is in this kind of supernatural war against good and evil. But the show didn't seem that way. I mean, the show really like, you know, spoke about the kind of winter is coming, Night King, you know, approach as like the biggest existential thing ever. And then to have it really only addressed in one episode, to have Cersei be proven completely right to not get involved, you know, I'm just kind of like, well, this all feels a bit like a, you know, and there's three more episodes to go. What'll it be like? I just feel like the stakes of the battle are going to feel so much lower when it's just the humans.
I'll admit that I'm excited for the return to politicking, because that's the part of Game of Thrones that I really like. At the same, like, time, I don't know that I can fathom how that is going to fill three supersized episodes, given, like, how much story we have left. Given that it's Cersei, who we've decided is bad, against a bunch of our heroes who I guess are infighting. And I think the thing that I'm dreading a little bit is that, like, I don't think all the infighting is believable. You know what I mean? Like, and once again, I'm assuming, like, you know, I don't know what happens for the most part in the last three episodes of Game of Thrones. And so, like, maybe I should just have more faith that they will be able to deliver something that's really interesting. And I have been saying, like, all along, I think the Night King is a really boring villain. I don't really want to watch them fight the Night King for, like, the final season. So I got my wish. So I feel like I can't, you know, but I share some of that, like, unease. I'm, like, a little uneasy about it. But at the same time, I'm like, well, maybe, you know, I loved last week's episode. And which was conversations in rooms, essentially, right? If there is more of that going forward, but it has to do with like politicking and humans' desires for power and stuff like, that is interesting to me. I'm just worried that is, I don't know. We've still got two live dragons that, you know, we're going to have like another battle or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's also just like, you know, I agree with you that the Night King was kind of a boring villain, because anyone who's that all powerful, that sort of relentless, like, it's just like, it's not very compelling episode after episode. But what was compelling was this sort of supernatural stuff surrounding him, this sense of like a universe, or at least a continent that's sort of out of supernatural balance, and that something needs to be restored, and all this prophecy about like, you know, ice and fire coming together. And it gave the union, or the eventual discord between Danny and John, a sort of like really like mythic weight to it. And now all of that magic stuff, as far as I can tell, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, is sort of done or settled. And so it's like, oh, so now it's just like a guy who's sleeping with his aunt, and like, you know, it I thought that there was going to be some reason they were pulled together, you know, and they didn't even really have much to do with the victory over the winter, you know, in the end. So it just kind of rendered John and Danny's whole kind of big, important, self-important arc sort of moot in a way. That said, you know, I was happy that Arya got her big moment. I mean, I feel conflicted about the ending, I guess, but like you said, I feel really uneasy about what the hell the next 3+ hours is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, we shall see, and maybe it will absolutely surprise us and knock our socks off. I will say that there's a part of me that likes this move here because, mm-hmm. It's so, let's kill Ned Stark in episode 9 of season 1. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what it feels like. It feels like you think this is the end game, but it's not. And it also makes me, I mean, and I say that in a way that it makes me look like such a fool because I've been railing against, this social media, hashtag that HBO has been using for the throne. And I'm like, you idiots, it doesn't matter. The throne is not the point anymore. And I'm like, oh. Guess the throne's back on the table. Yep. My bad.
Always trust the hashtag. Yeah.
I know. Follow the hashtag. So anyway, that's my fault. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's interesting. It's interesting for Lena Headey to have sat out 2 full episodes of the final season of Game of Thrones. That's kind of fascinating. So I feel like they must have some really fun stuff for her to do, but I don't know where she modulates from here, you know?
Well, that's another thing is like, I don't know if I feel comfortable having her positioned as the ultimate villain. You know, like, I don't really think, maybe that's not what they're doing, and I'm just basing this off a very vague, you know, preview for the next episode. But like, she's kind of the last one to go, you know, like, she's the last kind of opposition, supposedly, to this kind of uneasy alliance, you know, in the North. And it's like, well, okay, like, is that really what Cersei's character arc has been? Are we supposed to think that she's so wicked? And, you know, I just don't know that that's really where she was a season ago, you know, at least in my estimation. But, you know, again, this is the kind of thing when shows start to wrap up, you know, sometimes you're just like, oh, the people making the show think it's a different thing than I think it is, you know? And that's always interesting and a little disillusioning sometimes, but like, you kind of have to be like, well, I mean, if this is this is the show that they always felt they were making, then okay, then I'll just have to kind of watch it and accept it as that.
But also, like, you know, it's possible you and I are making the wrong assumptions about what the final 3 episodes will,
sure,
you know. And, sure. What's interesting is that I think something that I found kind of fascinating is what they're trying to position for Daenerys. Because if you think about, the fact that my friend Kim Renfro did a really good, piece about this at Business Insider, but she was talking about, how this season has done a lot to strip away the things that Daenerys had to rely on. Like, she comes to the North. She's the outsider, right? She's a little bit on the back foot already. Her newfound boyfriend is now, I guess, her competition, but also related to her. And so she's like feeling distance from him. She lost her entire Dothraki horde, in a very problematic opening salvo of the episode. She lost a lot of her Unsullied. Grey Worm and Missandei are like, should we just leave? Like, they just want to go, right? And then she lost Jorah. And so it's like, what, Tyrion and Varys? Like, her team is so small now. And yeah, like, her dragons are there, but they're like, one of them super wounded. And so, like, this idea that what will Daenerys do? Having come to Westeros with so much power, what will she do now that she has to rely on this Alliance of the North, now that this Alliance of the North isn't going as well as she had hoped? I don't really buy this whole, like, Jon and Daenerys in competition for the throne, because, like, Jon deeply doesn't care, and so that dynamic doesn't work. But the dynamic of, like, Daenerys coming in being like, okay, I got this, and I got the guy in the North to bend the knee, and so I got this. I'm doing it. And then it's all kind of falling apart around her. Mm-hmm. I think is potentially very interesting, you know, but yeah. I don't know exactly how it's going to play out.
Can we talk about the Dothraki thing? Because, I thought that shot was exquisite. I mean, and telling a sort of horrifying little story with just the use of black and like little dots of light, I thought was, you know, beautifully done.
I loved it. Yeah.
I mean, really striking, like, artistry there. And you got to think that, like, when Sapochnik came up, that he was like, oh my God, this is going to be so cool, you know? Yeah. But, that said, A, do I believe that every single Dothraki would die while Samwell Tarly lived throughout that whole ordeal? I don't. Also, I think, I mean, you said they were problematic. Are you kind of referring to the fact that they sent this horde of people of color kind of into the front lines to die first?
Yeah, I mean, the Dothraki screamers are going to be like the most likely to go first, though I don't know why they charged and didn't wait for the dead to come to them. I don't know battle tactics though. But but yeah, Daenerys's army is the army of color. And so if you have like Operation Get Behind the Dothraki, I mean, it just looks like it just doesn't look great. That being said, I completely agree with you. I think the light their Uruks and then have them disappear into the darkness and have everyone sort of like watch and realize what's happening in horror and then just like watch the darkness but hear the army of the dead coming and all of that. Like, I thought that was tremendous. It was just like, I don't blame anyone who's a little like, but okay. Why is Samwell Tarly still alive? Why?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, maybe that's something we could also talk about in this is that, you know, the odds makers, including myself and you, I believe, we're really kind of prepping. And we talked about it in the last week's episode of this podcast. Like, okay, like X major character's going to die and, you know, and, or Y character's going to die. And like really only Theon of the major character. I mean, I guess Jorah, you could argue, but like, you know, Lyanna Mormont, like Beric Dondarrion, like, okay, like those were characters that people liked. They were fan faves maybe, but like they weren't significant to the broader story. And I just feel like that also felt like a cop-out, especially when, like, I mean, under the sort of, you know, full-throated direction of Sapochnik, like, there were moments in the siege of Winterfell that were, like, excruciating to watch because it was this, like, full of dread and just, like, it seemed so helpless and impossible. And, you know, there are, like, zombies crawling all over everything. And you're telling me that none of the major characters died during that, you know?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, this battle had more casualties than the last few. Like, I was irritated by the lack of deaths in Beyond the Wall when, like, just Thorazmir died. And I was irritated by the lack of casualty in Spoils of War when, like, just some Tarleys died. And I was irritated by the lack of casualties in Battle of the Bastards when, like, sure, Ramsay died, but, like, no one fighting for the good guys died that we cared about. Like, I mean, one won the giant, I guess. So, I was looking forward to this battle being something that they were like, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to like more realistically kill some of your faves. And like, yeah, I mean, you can't gloss over the fact that Theon Greyjoy and Jorah Mormont died, though. I mean, I think part of where we trip ourselves up is like there was just 1 million articles on the internet of like who's gonna die. So we just like went to these extremes and like processed like all of our grief about all these people, like getting ready to lose everyone, and then it was like actually fairly minimal. I mean, mm-hmm. and especially when like why is the Sam thing really bothers me, because I love Sam as a hero. I love like a round bookish indoor cat hero. I love him, but like he had no business out on the fighting lines if he wasn't gonna like display any fighting skills. And we just see him swallowed up by like zombie horde after zombie horde and like somehow still being alive. There's one point when John just like runs past and he's like, I don't have time for your shit, Samwell Tarly. Like you're on the ground again covered in zombies. Like save yourself or get in the crypts where you belong, you know? Ed Tuller didn't die for that. Anyway, but yeah, there's this one part where they all go up on the ramparts, right? And, or the wall, whatever. Maybe I have the naming of castle parts wrong, but they're all up there and it's like every single, like, window up there. I think they're called Marins, but every single one has like a fave in it. It's like, there's Gendry, there's Jaime, there's Brienne, there's Pod, there's blah, blah, blah. They're all ready to like take on these zombies that are about to swarm over them. And every single one of them is fine. And I'm like, okay. I mean, I don't know. And it's like, I'm sure the writer's like, what more do you want? We killed Theon Greyjoy. And I'm like, yeah, that's the most emotional part of the episode for me is the death of the Theon Greyjoy, even though it was hugely telegraphed, even though it was hugely drawn out.
Even though it was 2 minutes before Arya killed the Night King and you're kind of like, oh, Theon, if you had just run the other direction, you might have lived.
But like, there's just something about Alfie Allen's face that like really gets me every time. So it worked for me. But yeah, I get it. I don't know. It's just like, there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't make any sense if you chew over it, but like visually very ambitious and you know, they really swung for it. And yeah, I mean, I like I said, you know, to retread old territory, I share your unease about what the next three episodes are going to be, but I like the like bravery of this move.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, it will be interesting, and maybe it will be nice to see the show settle back down into the scale that it first was when it's, you know, for the first few seasons, when it really was just about these people kind of struggling with each other for a throne that increasingly feels like it means less and less.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what damage this battle does to them. Like Daenerys is the person who lost the most in this battle, right? That's accurate to say. Right?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think your assessment of, like, yeah, just exactly all that she lost. Like, she's in trouble if she's going to kind of splinter away from the rest of these people.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's an interesting thing to me is, like, when thinking about who might die in this episode, I was just sort of thinking, in terms of grief calculus, like, what would impact people the hardest? And that's why, you know, like, that's why I thought someone like Tormund would die so that John would really feel the loss of something. But like, you know, yeah, John liked Ed, but like not, you know, I don't know, not that much. So like, I don't know that John is really, he's going to feel bad for Daenerys that she lost Jorah, but like, John doesn't really have like stakes in this. And then like, you know, the Stark sisters are just going to be like, yeah, guess what? We did it again. We rule. So you know, I don't know. I don't know how it's all going to go, but it's going to be fascinating to see, what comes from this. And I'm still waiting for my guy Varys. I mean, this is the interesting thing is like when Littlefinger died at the end of last season, my whole thought process around that was like, yeah, because this is the death of a certain kind of story. This is the death of politicking in Game of Thrones, and now we're in something. There's no room for a Littlefinger in what the show is about to be. And then I was wrong because we're back to politicking, which makes me glad that Varys is still here because this is where Varys shines. And so, like, Con Lothil has had very little to do. He did okay in the crypts, quipping a little bit or whatever, but like, I'm really hoping that my guy Varys has more to do as we go.
Yeah, let's put him on the throne. Why not?
Yeah, Varys for the throne. All right. Well, is there anything else we want to chat about?
No, I feel like that pretty much covered it. I don't mean to be too negative on the episode. It's just the more I think about it, the more I'm like, But, you know, yeah. In the moment, it was like gripping television.
No, I was like completely in it when I was
cheered.
In it.
I cheered when Arya, you know, stabbed the king.
And like, maybe if you just like, yeah, if you just watch it once, like, and cheer and like are in the cheering mood, then like, I can see this being like a great, episode of television to like watch with your friends on the couch or like whatever. If you're like us and you have to process back through an episode because it's your job, I don't think this really holds together. So that's sort of my assessment of it. All right. Well, I think we both agree though that the episode, like, the special effects looked amazing. And so I'm really excited to talk to Joe Bauer and Steve Kolbeck, who worked on the VFX for The Long Night.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
We are joined today by visual effects producer Steve Kolbeck and visual effects supervisor Joe Bauer. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. It's our pleasure.
Can you guys run down for us really quickly what the difference is between a visual effects producer and a visual effects supervisor?
If you use filmmaking as the metaphor for it all, Joe is the director and I'm the producer. So I'm responsible for air traffic control, logistics, schedule, money, and putting boots on the ground. And Joe is responsible for all things creative and
some methodology.
And together we trade hats occasionally, but Joe is the vision behind it all.
The method means emotional, psychological encouragement, and the maker of things happening.
I love that. When I was talking to Sam Conway a couple weeks ago, he said, you know, it all starts where you guys sit down and you look at the scripts and you decide sort of what's going to be practical, what's going to be digital. How did you all react when you saw what was on the page for this episode?
we sat in silence, much like we're doing now. No, I mean, the thing about this this series is that it's been sort of an ideal rollout, of at least in our world, and I think hopefully in the other departments as well. But you know, we've been challenged to invent things every year to meet the needs of the words on the page, and drawing from our own experience in the business and doing this work, and also with, as the show's gotten more popular, we've gotten access to some really, really all of the A-list talent that this industry provides. So, you know, so in season three, the first time we burned someone with real fire, and obviously not really burning them, but a stunt guy, one guy. By season five, we had the flamethrower on a motion control crane in Spain, and we burned 20 guys. You know, every year, it's, you know, and the first time we did the skeletal whites, we did like five of them. And this last, right. You know, season eight, as you saw last night, we did, you know, tens of thousands. So the rollout of the asks for season eight has been sort of long in coming. And so we know how to do it. It just becomes a logistical question of volume, really.
Every season, we generally start with an outline that's usually over 100 pages, and you know, you scan through, and like all production personnel, you read through it for, you know, what are your parts, and you know, you bullshit, bullshit, bullshit me, bullshit me, bullshit me, it's always been, you know, you read through it and you go, oh my God, how are we possibly going to do this? And this year was, no, really, how are we possibly going to do this? And, you know, one of our colleagues, Chris Newman, who's been heavily responsible for a lot of the organization and scheduling of it all, you know, he said, hey, you know, even the best potato peeler in the world peels them one at a time. And, as the pressure mounted and we knew what we were getting in for, we just, you know, broke it down. We made our lists and, you know, we start with in all the same typical ways. And we had a massive team working with us on the ground doing previs, which started for the episode three back in July of 2017. And that team from a company called The Third Floor has been our sort of rock and ace in the hole for the last several years. And you just break the shots down and get them into a creative place where everybody's happy with the shape and the look of the scene. And then it's, all right, what does this shot need? And, you know, it's an immense playbook that Joe and the team put together.
Yeah, it's basically reverse engineering the shots that everyone's happy with, you know, and in some cases, many cases, the first unit, not on this show, but in general, the first unit would go out and shoot a bunch of stuff, and then it would go into the computers and everything would be filled in with CG, and that's becoming a tried and true method, but this is such the look of this show is so low tech that we're afraid that if we went directly to CG that we would never meld successfully with the photography. So, and the art direction, just the feel of the show. So, production allowed us increasingly over the seasons to shoot more and more practical elements that would then be nested within the digital work, so that as your eyes watching different parts of the screen, you recognize things that are photographed, and it sort of grounds the digital work, and that's been sort of the secret of our success.
And a bit of our signature, Joe's signature, is actually shooting things. And wherever possible, if anything can be shot, might be shot, would be shot, we shot it. And the beauty of having that material in hand is that it's organic, it's real, and it's authentic. And then the parts that you need to fake kind of nest in around it. You know, they need to be better when they're needing to be CG, because they're also, you know, fitting in with reality, and that reality also helps ground it. So, you know, going back to season 5, when we plop down a dragon in the middle of a fighting pit, right, in France, you know, Joe had the great outlandish and completely psychotic idea of animating the dragons first and putting a flamethrower on a techno dolly, and you know, it was real, and it fit in the dragon's mouth, and it really blasted the stunties, and you know, all of that part was already in camera, you know, when we walked off to the floor. But until that point, you know, all the jaws that were dropping were the producers and the director, and you know,
but not stunts. Not stunts, interestingly enough, who really welcomed the robotics of it all, and it because it's such a, you know, if done incorrectly, is such a dangerous thing to do. But our team, you know, is smart and does it correctly. But they really liked the fact that it was completely repeatable, and it made their planning much safer, honestly.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite things it's one of my favorite things to see in the behind the scenes videos is those cranes with the fire, the flames shooting out, and the actors responding to sort of just this like robotic arm with flame that eventually will have a dragon attached to it. And I mean, like, I was watching the making of for this episode, and you've got this great rig that you made for Viserion so that the flame would sort of spill out of the wounds of the dragon. Can you talk a little bit about how you made that?
Yeah, there are a couple of places that have been established on Viserion since he was originally harpooned by the Night King last year. Or actually, season 6. Was it 6 or 7?
7.
Was 7, yeah.
Sorry, it's been one long 7-year-long year. But and then he got heavily damaged in the fight with Drogon last night, and also Rhaegal. Actually, Rhaegal, I think, is the one who tore his face off. So, you know, we have a digital model of that was created for damaged Viserion, and we were able to scale that and get it 3D printed, those areas where the fire would interact, you know, with his surface. And then, as we do, we pre-animated his action. And then our geniuses, our virtual, what'd you call Kaya?
A virtual supervisor.
Yeah. They transferred the axes of motion to a robotic arm that we had access to, and then Sam Conway and his team piped it with gas and fire, and we just went through a very long menu of you know, bits of business during the 3 cutbacks to 5 cutbacks to Viserion and John in the courtyard, and just rolled those things off. And it really worked great. And, you know, you could see how well the fire interacted with the dragon and you know, how, you know, it was a bit elaborate for what the element is, but there was so much of it, and it was pretty close to camera, and I think it really worked well.
And then what's the process of coloring the fire blue or the wildfire green? How does that work?
The blue color we established last year, and actually one of our DPs, Greg Middleton, created an interactive look when Viserion is blasting the wall. And there's a practical piece of set with a little crow's nest that Tormund and Beric are in. And he created, using programmed light panels and different gelling, different colors, and that it goes at a really fast cadence, so it almost has an electrical quality. So when you know, we shot the fire the same way that we always do, but then, you know, we started experimenting with the different values of the fire and you know, turning the orange color into those different hues that were represented in the interactive, and then we added, you know, luminance adjustments and just played with it until the fire itself had the same electrical quality that the interactive did. And so, you know, it's just in the digital intermediate step, which we call DI, and even before that in compositing, you know, we just shifted the colors over, and it took a little while for the vendors to get the knack of it. But once they did, it really adds so much in a very different feel than the orange fire. You want to talk about the wildfire?
The wildfire was basically photographed as fire, and mats were created for it so that we could color it in DI. It was really important to the guys in season two when we did the Battle of Blackwater that that the green fire play a prominent role because it's so iconic in the mythos of King's Landing. But then there was also a concern, of course, well, you know, obviously we don't want it to look hokey. And so one of the sort of rules that we came up with at the time was that the explosion of the fire, of the wildfire itself, would have the green hue, and that would be dialed in DI. And then any subsequent fires that would be created as a result of the explosion would play as traditional real orange fire. So it had its role, but then it didn't, you know, endure for the balance of the scene. And that was partially, you know, fear-based, but ultimately served the story well, and we could focus on the explosion without then having a question where, you know, where is this green fire coming from?
Right, exactly. And then I'm curious about, you know, so you're working with this army of the dead in this episode, and obviously you've got some guys in prosthetics, some in more prosthetics than not, stuff like that, that you're going to have to go in and fill in the digital, you know, digitally fill in the green bits on their bodies and stuff like that. But then you also have, you've got to have like a digital enhancement of that because I saw that swarm of the dead and I know you didn't do just guys for that. So how do you match the movements of, you know, the actual actors that you're doing and these, added CG, whites that you're creating here?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways. We got some motion control suits, and Steve will remember what the technology is called.
It's called the Movin suit, and it's basically a jumpsuit that has a variety of tracking markers on it and cameras that are set up in a space that's called a volume, so that wherever the suit is in this volume, they're able to read the movements of certain limbs. And depending on how many sensors you have on it, it you know, can narrow down to how specific the movements are. But ultimately, it was sort of a less exotic version of motion capture. You know, kind of almost a poor man's version of motion capture.
I mean, we've gone as basic as put four or five cameras around a bunch of stunt guys and have them climb around and jump on objects or fight each other, you know, and sometimes we just use that footage and send it to the vendors. We sync it up so that they can see the same action from all different points of view, and then they rotomate it with their digital models. So that's a laborious way to do it, but it does work.
And that's how we started. When we first did in season four, when we did the first battle where whites were, you know, going after Bran and Jojen as they were trudging through the north, it was, you know, four different whites that were more skeletal based that were wearing green suits, and this was all Joe's concoction.
Well, yeah, the idea was to be production friendly so that the fight could be treated the same. We still were doing this up through this season, so that the fights could be choreographed with the stunt guys and photographed the usual way. And then, you know, just we'd shoot a couple of extra background plates, and then the green is removed and the skeletal parts are put in. But when they're completely skeleton, and you saw some of them climbing up the walls of Winterfell last night, for example, or as you say, when the whites first attack and they the big tidal wave comes out of the darkness in a couple of different angles. You know, some of that is computer simulations, but, you know, when there's just too many limbs and too much to animate joint by joint, then you sort of let the computer parameters and let the computer do it.
And that's a software called Massive.
So when you have a swarm of whites like that, how important is it that each one is like individuated? How do you make sure that it looks like a swarm of different moving things and not something that you know, looks too repetitive or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, the best example of that this year was when the whites were swarming on the dragon
after
came down and saved John. And that's a very, very tricky thing because each white has at least five joint positions, you know, I'd say five. And then they're all interacting with each other and they're interacting with the surface of the dragon and the dragon's moving. So, you know, you work with points of contact and, you know, and one of the things that, you know, the vendors would send us passes that they thought were largely successful because you put in parameters and then you see, you know, you cook it and then you see what you get. And, you know, there was some crazy behavior from some of the whites. They're passing through each other, or they're disappearing into the dragon, or they're just doing, you know, exorcism kind of stuff. So we had to just go through and weed out the weirdos pretty much. And then the ones that survived are the ones that you saw. And then they were textured with photography of our real whites that, you know, the ones that Barry Gower and his team did the prosthetics on and the costume department costumed, and then we lit them the same way. So, you know, we went through quite a few steps to make sure that they looked like the guys who were in camera.
We set up a station that's called a photogrammetry, sort of a cyber scanning type station, and basically it's a tent where you can go and stand on a mark, and there are hundreds of high resolution still cameras pointing at that mark so that every square inch of an individual can be photographed and that can be the basis of a 3D model.
For some reason, Steve and I never went in there and had action figures of ourselves made. I really regret that.
it's true there are no action figures of us, but we can hand sculpt something out of, you know, leftover donuts in the kitchen.
But and they're very lifelike, oddly enough.
But you can move through, you know, hundreds of individuals in a day because you just walk in, stand on your mark, cop a T-pose, and hit fire, and it flashes a picture that can then produce a model. And we had a team, a company called Clear Angle out of London, that was our maester of that. And then those models can be, they can, and the textures, the photographed images can be the basis of the individual creatures that are climbing on the back of the dragon or participating in the swarm so that, you know, they can be very highly customizable to the needs of your scene, your production, your cast.
Is there when doing this particular episode where you've got an army of the dead, you've got a giant white, you've got three dragons, you've got the White Walkers, all of this, is there a problem you encountered that you maybe thought was insurmountable and you figured out a way to solve it?
Well, there was a moment.
But besides, how are we going to do all of this?
besides all of it, yeah.
The trickiest particular problem is when we had a shot that was, you know, bought and everybody wanted it in the show, and it turned out schedule wise that we had to shoot the camera on a crane. We had to shoot the background before we shot the foreground action, and that was really weird. So it's like tying your shoe, you know, with a shoelace before you own the shoe. So we had to, there's a lot of steps to it, but ultimately we threw technology at it and had the actor fly in, Ian White, who plays the giant, the production flew him in from London. and he just sort of mimed his performance that he would be doing for real 6 months later. And we did the the multiple cameras, and then they made a CG model that acted the way he did. And then when we got to set, there was a piece of equipment called
N-cam.
Yeah. So that allowed, it was just some stuff stuck to the camera that allowed the camera operators to see that digital model, as stuck to the ground in the set. So as far as they were concerned, when they were operating, the crane and the camera, there was a 15-foot giant standing in the set with the real actors, and so they were able to shoot him the same way they shot them, and then we played that motion back as a motion control move when we had Ian in several months later in his full costume, and he did his same action again. But it was just kind of a weird cart before the horse way of doing it, but we did have the technology to make it happen.
So we sort of workshopped it with Ian and Miguel and Fabian, where Ian went through his performance where he lifts up Liana Mormont is the moment mm-hmm. we're talking about. And,
right.
and so we had a scaled, half-scale Liana dummy that he could pick up and interact with. And while, they were workshopping it, we actually shot it. And then did this rotomation technique where we basically copy his movements and created a 3D version of him that we could then plug into the computer and bring out to the set. And so this 3D positional tracking gizmatronic called NCAM was attached to the camera. And so once you map out what the set is and you attach the equipment to the camera, it knows where the camera is looking in 3D space, and then you can plug in the animation of the creature, in this case our giant, and rather than us having to map out for the camera operator a very particular, very esoteric and difficult to follow move so that the shot could be assembled later, we actually played back the performance and they could be in the set with it. So it's as if you have your monster in the room with you and you can follow it with your camera and see it on the screen as if it's really there. And that is called simulcam, and it's been used before on other kinds of projects, but was a first for us and made it very efficient and easy to solve that potentially impossible problem. Because the alternative would have been we would need to have recreated the move completely in CG and had to create the environment and all of the people
man.
In it.
And
the environment would not have been necessarily problematic, but all of the extras running through while the craziness was going on and Liana having to do her thing, Bella doing her thing, and then it's a whole other story how we got Bella in his hands, which was quite a challenging virtual cinematography feat.
So I was watching
you about it if you have another half hour.
Well, I mean, I was watching, they went into it on the making of that they released on YouTube. And so you get to see, like, Bella Ramsey in this, like, green rig that she's being held up in the air. And then you get to see Ian holding this little green mannequin. So I'm sort of like, but the process of knitting those two together, that feels like sort of digital mastery. I mean, is that like, easier than it looks or harder than it looks to put those two performances together?
I mean, I think the fact that we shot, we figured it out ahead of time and shot as much as we did made the end result easier than it might have been if you just winged it and threw it at the vendor. You know, in this case, it was Weta Digital, which is Peter Jackson's company in New Zealand, very well known.
Right.
In the pre-Hobbit days, they were very much, they approached these things very much the way we were approaching Thrones. Which is to shoot a whole bunch of stuff, and then they threw high technology at it. That's what we're doing. But, so we were working with the right people who knew how to, knit it together. But, we did shoot everything correctly. So it wasn't, it was a much easier task for them than it might have been.
Our secret weapons in this case were Casey Schatz, S-C-H-O-T-Z, and Kaya Jabbar, J-A-B-B-A-R, and they were our virtual supervisors. And it's really amazing what they've done to be able to help us put these pieces together. And they oversaw all of the motion-based work and the motion control fire.
Yeah, I mean, these guys had just finished Dumbo with Tim Burton, and then, you know, and went off to Star Wars and Avatar, and, you know, so that's the level of technical talent who are, you know, who block out huge chunks of their life to come and work with us in Belfast,
right.
and we're quite lucky for that.
And they're
busy, yeah.
Everyone's crazy busy, and sort of one of our secrets to success and how we're able to turn things around relatively fast compared with some of our feature brothers and sisters is we just do an insane amount of planning, and we map this stuff out so well, and we have a very in-depth playbook that is, you know, mostly schematics and diagrams and charts, and, you know, for any given shot, the potentially dozens of pieces that are needed to be photographed and captured, whether it's on the ground on the first unit or as an element shoot later on, was really our ace in the hole. And we had a fellow named Eric Carney, who was one of the principals of the third floor and started with us years ago as a previs supervisor, and who grew into one of our absolute champion onset supervisors. And he was on the ground for our 57 nights of shooting with the playbook and just making sure that everything was captured as it needed to be captured, and then thinking on his feet as the needs of the set changed and didn't allow us to get X, Y, or Z, but now, you know, how do we do it anyway? And so it's having this extraordinary team was really our way to get through the four and sometimes five units that we're shooting simultaneously to, you know, kill not just this episode, but the other five.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious, in this episode, we see the end of the Night King and the White Walkers. And this is an effect that you guys have worked on and mastered, sort of perfected over the years. Like, I remember the first, you know, like the evolution of what the White Walkers look like until this sort of perfected form. But what is it like to say goodbye to an effect that you've worked on for so long?
Oh, it's okay. No, you know, I mean, the season has required us, we worked most days of the week of the year, you know, until we got to from back here to L.A. And then our average week was 6-day weeks and frequently seven. So, you know, I mean, and it really, really needed it. And this year, too, is the first season that I didn't supervise all of the episodes. Just because when we added up at the very beginning of season eight, you know, we added up, guesstimated how many shots, and it was heading toward twice the number of season seven, and we skated in on our stomachs on season seven. So Stefan Fangmeier, who had worked with us before and has a very rich resume, came on and did episodes 1, 2, and 4. So, and then I did 3, which aired last night, 5, and 6, which is the finale. So, anyway, that's, yeah. So I feel like we've done justice to everything that we've been asked to create. And, you know, I can't imagine now, but, you know, it's funny, every year you think there's no way this can get bigger. And every year, you know, it, you know, as Steve says, it doubles in size like the dragons. And I think that we would have all just exploded, literally, you know, like the Night King, if there were 10 more shots asked of us. So we're all going to go to Betty Ford and recover, and then see what happens next.
It's been a series, you know. Season 8 has been a season of lasts. You know, it's, oh my God, it's the last production meeting. Oh my God, it's our last shoot. Oh my God, it's the last time we're gonna, you know. We're going to be on the edge of a cliff know, flying in a sideways rainstorm, you know, with a drone trying to get the shot. And of course, it's, you know, after being together for so many years, it's, there is a, certainly a touch of nostalgia and family. And, you know, we've been really lucky to have such an amazing, insane crew, not just in production and in the hands of the camera operators and the grips and the lighting, which has all been very true, but also, you know, we've been very fortunate to have, and Bernie Caulfield and Chris Newman, you know, producers who really understand and want to do everything in their power to support their team and empower their team, you know. And then in our visual effects team, it's, you know, we're a family. And at this point, the family is nearing the end. And, you know, the kids are going off to college. And it's a...
the grandparents are retiring.
Not quite yet, but feeling like it. And, you know, so the last, you know, we just had our last DEI session. And, you know, it's a big deal.
There's a lot of hugging it out with everybody, you know. I mean, it's... You know, you've really...
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's something that I wanted to sort of convey to people who are listening is, like, you know, I asked you guys if you wanted to chat a couple weeks ago, and you were like, no way. We are in it. We are working on the season. We cannot lift our heads up to do this, which is totally understandable. But I think people don't understand the timeline of sort of like when you turn things around versus when we see them on the screen. So, like, how up to... the last minute are you ever working on a digital effect before it goes live on HBO?
Yeah, they feel like they're minutes apart, but they're not. I mean, it's, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
I mean, the schedule is meant to be completely all in and done, 17 weeks to air, but we have shots on in episode 5 that are downloading as we speak, and episode 6, so... You know, we're at the very last bits of polishing and, you know, and fine tuning. So it's not like there's any jeopardy at this point in this season that, you know, we're going to miss it.
We've had other seasons that were much more exciting.
But there were seasons where, you know, we literally slid into home on our faces with you know, the shots on a hard drive in our hands with somebody racing to take it away.
If we were 30 minutes later, it wouldn't air in France.
You know? Yeah, poor France. But, you know, it is a high stress, challenging environment. And
we don't make it easy. I mean, with all of the our insistence on shooting everything, you know, it puts a burden sort of on production and on us, on we ourselves, but it is worth it, and we have the right people to do it, and production enables us to do it, so we're sort of beholden to the end product and to, you know, the fans and the people of, you know, HBO and just ourselves, really, to do the best work we can, because it's so much work. Even if we did a bad job, it'd still be a lot of work, so we might as well try to do a good job.
Are you guys working on the spinoff, on the prequel series that they're doing?
No, that's happening simultaneously, actually. They're already in pre-production. A woman that we both have known for a long time, Betsy Patterson, is the effects supervisor on that. And she's back in Belfast and the same stomping grounds that we occupied for the last 7 and 8 years. And they are... creating very much their own thing, you know, and they're attacking it their own way, and we say more power to them.
So there isn't like a shared library or of like a visual effects or sounds or anything like that goes between the two projects?
Sounds there might be, but the you know, the shots are so specific, and then what we shoot for the shots is so specific that, you know, there may be models that they could, you know, dragon models, there may be some things that they can, you know, repurpose, but not a lot. honestly.
We have a we have a rich library of assets that we've created, you know, down through the ages, digital assets, yeah. Whether it's, you know, ships or
boats,
you know, King's Landing or Castle Black or the Godswood Tree and yeah. that sort of stuff. And you know what, we don't really know anything about the story or the mythos or where it's going, but you know, we have our absolute right hand, left hand, and most of our brain cells in between is a fellow named Adam Chazen, who's our associate producer, and he's busy as we speak, you know, working on a legacy project to archive all of the digital assets that exist from our little experience here, and pass them on wherever they'll be valuable, and you know, and we imagine that at some point along the way somebody will call and say, hey, how did you do X, Y, or Z? And you know, we're of course thrilled to right. help out.
Excellent. Yeah, well, thank you so much for the time. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I did get a call last year when we were prepping season 8, and it was from one of the supervisors at Marvel asking how we did something. And, you know, we're all watching each other's work and trying to, you know, figure out how each other is doing things. And, you know, when you can't figure it out, you just pick up a phone and call. And, you know, because we're all geeks and fans and workaholics, and it's nice to pick each other's brains because, you know, we're all doing the same work.
The Lord's work.
I love that. Excellent. Well, I will have my eyes peeled for Ice Zombie Dragons in a Marvel movie. And no, I'm just kidding. And and thank you guys so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot. It was fun talking.
All right, well, that is it for our discussion of The Long Night. We will be back next week to talk about whatever it is. Episode 4 is called We Don't Know. This episode of this podcast was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. Richard, until next week, where can people find you?
Cersei's having like a small pool party, so I'm going to go to that for a bit, I think. But I'll also be tweeting at Rylaws and writing at VF.com. And I should mention, if listeners of this podcast want to hear Joanna and I talk about another sort of big ending thing involving Starks, you can listen to last week's episode of Little Gold Men, where we discuss Avengers Endgame. But until we talk about Game of Thrones again, Joanna, where can people find you?
Well, I'm not invited to the pool party, but I will be downstairs in Qyburn's lab because he's cooking up something like really creepy.
He's barbecuing?
Yeah. Qyburn on the barbecue. A barbecue Qyburn. Nope, it doesn't work. All right. Anyway, I will be there.
It works. It works if you believe it, Joanna.
Over there, you find me on vanityfair.com. Follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Yes, please do listen to that episode of Little Gold Men where we had Griffin Newman of the Blank Check podcast on to talk about Avengers Endgame, and it was great. And we will see you all next week.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.